that these things are painful to sit with oftentimes. And so this is where the importance of practicing loving kindness comes in, metta. When people come to a retreat, they want to have an insight into not self. They want to be able to let go of thoughts about the self and thoughts about others and experience spacious emptiness. But then when there is a conventional self sitting a retreat that does have some significant discomfort, at such times, the appropriate thing to do is to generate metta. One has to support the conventional being, that feeling that we all have of being a self, so that the process of having insights into not self can be supported, can be nourished. And as is the tendency of a lot of modern people, there is a lot of ill will aimed at the self sometimes, and sometimes a withholding of loving kindness towards oneself. There is a lot of fault finding with others and with our own practice. So it's almost like, as a balance, we have to drop some kindness into the mind as well. Lumpo Anan often says, keep the mind in the middle, keep the mind in the middle. But if the mind does go out of balance, that can mean bringing things back into balance with an antidote, reflection, or a remedy. So Lord Buddha, of course, did encourage the practice of loving kindness. One of the instructions that he gave the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis was that after their alms round, when they have their meal, that they should spread loving kindness to the villagers upon whom they depend on alms, and then all beings. But one starts with oneself and then with the beings who support one in holy life. Thanajan Anand, when I was living with him, also spoke frequently about how loving kindness supports the cultivation of sati, because whenever the hindrances are strong in the mind, that tends to weaken the sati, the mindfulness. And if one cultivates loving kindness as a daily discipline, the level of anger, irritation, aversion is less. And then Lord Buddha says in the 11 Benefits of Loving Kindness Sutta, one of the main benefits of loving kindness practice is that those who cultivate metta, their minds become peaceful easily. So most people want to experience a peaceful mind. So here we have Lord Buddha saying very explicitly, expressly, metta is an important factor. People who cultivate metta, their minds become peaceful easily. So it starts as thoughts, but what we're really aiming at is it's more of an energy. Could see it as an attitude, an emotion. But we start with thoughts. We start by having a skillful attitude. So the attitude is, because you are a person who is attempting to cultivate virtue and cultivate your mind, then it's appropriate to support that. Just as you would support a friend who wanted to do something noble, something good, you're going to support yourself in your noble aspiration, in your noble practice. It's an appropriate attitude. And then the other thing to understand is the mind needs objects. So if it doesn't have a wholesome object, it's very often likely going to have an unwholesome one, sometimes neutral. But the mind tends to fall into the hindrances if we don't place it on an object to be mindful of or a wholesome object. So when we cultivate loving kindness, we are picking up what Lord Buddha described as a Brahma Vihara, a divine abiding. So we're picking up something wholesome, placing that in the mind for a period of time. This skillfully suppresses other unskillful mind states. So in that way, it supports us. It also produces a merit. And the merit that it produces, the merit that comes from mental cultivation, specifically ripens as more concentration, more insight. So it's a very helpful type of merit that we will be directly useful to us in our mental cultivation. So it's a good thing to cultivate. I might just tell some stories, perhaps, of the power of metta. Sometimes it's nice to get a bit inspired. We have in the time of the Buddha, the raging elephant that Devadatta agitated and released upon the Buddha, chasing after him in Rajgya. The Buddha raises his hand, spreads loving kindness, and angry, agitated elephant just kind of calms down. It's like the coolness of Lord Buddha's metta just cooled the fires of the enraged elephant. We don't often see wild elephants in this day and age very much, so people might not understand that that's a really significant thing. If an elephant is angry, suppose an elephant's in rut. I've seen some clips of elephants that go a bit crazy in Thailand, and people get killed by angry elephants. It's not difficult for a very, very heavy creature who is that strong to squash a human being. So for the Buddha to raise his hand and for a very angry, very large elephant to just stop, calm down, this is powerful. You also have the occasion of the serial killer, Angulimala, having killed 99 people and chopped off their fingers. The Buddha saw actually that Angulimala was capable of understanding Dhamma, that he'd cultivated significant virtue in the past but had become temporarily deluded by this very evil mind state. But underneath, there was previously cultivated a lot of goodness. He was someone who could be helped. So Lord Buddha walks in front of him, and then Angulimala chases after him. Angulimala was a very big and strong, athletic person, but he couldn't catch the Buddha. He yells out, "Stop!" The Buddha turns around and says, "No, you stop. I stopped a long time ago being doing harmful things." And he taught Angulimala. And so the metta of the Buddha, obviously that's a different level, but it's a case in point where metta, the kind of power that metta can cultivate. Can you imagine someone who's already killed 99 people who's determined to kill you too? You turn around, you face them, you spread metta to them, you give them a little teaching. Not only did he not kill the Buddha, he actually attained to a profound insight into Dhamma. Realize not self, glimpse nirvana. So, but that was of course due to his accumulated skillful practice in the past. There are other occasions, more contemporary occasions. There was one monk who I met at Wat Mapton actually many years ago. His name was Lumpur Supa. He had walked to India. This generation of monks is really something else. He had walked to India and then to Afghanistan and then to Pakistan and then walked back through China, stopping off in Shaolin, then came back to Thailand, then spent 40 years in the jungle, at which point the devas said to him, please come and encourage human beings, build a monastery. And I believe he lived to be about 120, if I'm not mistaken, close to 120. I think when I met him, he may have been 108. Anyway, remarkable. Remarkable bhikkhu. So at one point he was wandering in the forest and he actually got lost. And he, getting lost in the jungle, in the remote, you understand that just a few generations ago, Thailand was, I think, 85% tropical rainforest and jungle. So the population is much smaller. So to get lost in a dark, dense jungle, not knowing where the village is, so serious. He came across a herd of elephants, and most of the elephants were agitated by his presence. But one elephant, probably an elephant that had some accumulated merit that was receptive to metta, actually stood between Lumpur Supa and the angry elephants, protected him to some degree, because Lumpur Supa probably had other abilities, not just loving kindness. Certainly he had very good sila, samadhi, and he may have been able to talk with the elephant also, mind to mind, telepathically. So the elephant understood that the bhikkhu was lost. And so the elephant started walking off, and Lumpur Supa understood that he should follow. And then the elephant led Lumpur Supa to the edge of the jungle where there was a path leading to a village. Apparently, many years later, when Lumpur Supa was the abbot of this monastery down in Phuket, I believe, a young man came in and paid respects to him. And Lumpur Supa, with his abilities, could see that the young man that paid respects to him was the rebirth of the elephant. And due to the merit of having helped him, he was able to take a human birth and able to come and meet him again. So in this way, we can see that metta is very powerful. In terms of our practice, just offering yourself some kind support when things are rough. And we often, we chant the Metta Sutta, we aspire to have boundless and impartial loving kindness for all beings. That's all very good, very noble. But what do you do when it just seems too hard? What do you do when the ideals seem far away and our own feet are stuck in mud? You know, when you're looking at the sky, but your feet are in mud and you can't fly. Sometimes it feels like quicksand. Not only are your feet in mud, you're also sinking. So we all have this. One of the things that I have had developed some understanding about over the years is that when we come to do a meditation retreat, some of the things that ripen in our mind are not necessarily related to where we are or that moment. Sometimes karmas that we cultivated in past lives can also ripen in the mind as a difficult and painful mind state. That's part of living in a matrix of karma. We've all done many skillful things, we've all done many unskillful things, and these things ripen in various ways. Sometimes as unpleasant people or difficult situations, but sometimes as painful emotions, seemingly with no detectable cause in the present. So I think it's important to understand that we all need metta, and then to allow oneself to give it to oneself. So how do we do that? One thing that I have found helpful is just to go to the area of the heart in terms of where to place your mindfulness and notice, what does it feel like if there's restlessness? What does it feel like if there's some kind of agitation? What does it feel like if there's self-doubt? Or what does it feel like if an old grudge keeps coming up and you don't want to think negative thoughts, but they keep coming back? And just have a look. Is there painful feelings present? Is there dukkha? And if there is, then rather than judging that, and rather than trying to push it away, and rather than reacting to a painful phenomena with more negativity, just acknowledge that there is a conventional being that is experiencing some suffering. And then the very best thing to do in that moment, in my experience, is to offer some acceptance of that. This is the way it is. Lumpur Samedo says very often, it's like this. We come to meditate. The mind is like this. Allow it. Don't be contentious with it. And then if you can bring a certain cool quality of loving acceptance first, because pushing it away or trying to replace it too quickly sometimes doesn't work, very often doesn't work. What seems to work in my experience is allowing it some space, giving it some loving acceptance. And then we offer an attitude of friendliness towards it, loving kindness, loving friendliness. And we simply add the words, often breathing in Buddho, breathing out Buddho, breathing in Buddha, breathing out Do. Still aware of the breath, we change the words, breathing in, may I be well. Breathing out, may I be happy. And we can give a little bit of thought of what it might mean to be well, what it might mean to be happy. We can make those words have some meaning. What it might mean to be well might mean, you know, having more peaceful meditations, being disciplined and with your meditation and developing skills of meditation, having more peaceful meditations. That might be an important component of being well, being happy. But we're offering an attitude of loving friendliness. You can also call it pure love. So it's not romantic love, it's not It's not a type of love based on attachment. It's a type of love based on goodwill. And sometimes the word unconditional love might be helpful, that you just, especially when you're just allowing the mind state, it's already there. So one allows it to be as it is, accepts it for a period of time, this is the way it is. And then, may I be well, may I be happy. And when you say those words, you try to give rise to a feeling of warmth and friendliness, of goodwill in the heart area. Breathing in, may I be well. Breathing out, may I be happy. Just allowing the warmth of metta to be in the heart. And if there's a painful mind state, it's like, then there becomes two things in the mind. There's the painful mind state, the difficult mind state, but there's also the intention to generate loving kindness. It's already changing the dynamic. You've got a difficult mind state, the result of past karmas. You're applying a skillful method recommended by the Buddha and the Arhants, setting the intention to cultivate a skillful meditation object. You're already changing that karma, putting down new auspicious karma. And if we just keep at it sincerely, it's as though the negative mind state can be washed away by the power of the metta. We just make that wish, may I be well, may I be happy, may I be well, may I be happy. And what normally happens is the intensity of the negative mind state or the painful emotion or the grudge or whatever it is gets less and less. And little moments of warmth, moments of a pleasant feeling, kind of there's chinks in the armor, it starts to dissolve. And then we can do insight practice as well, like just observe that mind states change, because a lot of our suffering is that sense of, when will it ever change? Why is it always like this? Notice it does change. It's changing over time. And we can use our metta, apply the metta, notice the way a very unskillful mind state gets less in power. That also has feelings. If you're doing your citta nupassana and you're having a look in that chest area, that negative, the hindrances, the painful emotions, that's a feeling in there. As you apply the metta, the feelings might be less intense. There may be more neutral feelings. And then as you keep going, what happens is more and more pleasant feelings begin to replace the unpleasant feelings. And then if we're very diligent and very sincere and very consistent, Lord Buddha describes metta as a divine abiding. The feelings associated with metta become very rapturous, very tranquil, very expansive. So what can start as a contracted, painful, jarring, sharp mind state, unruly, hot, whirling, can become spacious, warm, exultant, boundless. And so we're replacing the unwholesome with the wholesome, lessening our attachment to mind states that produce negative karma, consciously, deliberately generating a mind state that produces very potent, good karma. And then once we use it as a skillful method in this way, often people find it's easy then to be with the breath. Use the metta, replacement by opposites. You've used the metta, brought in a skillful mind state, and now inclining the mind to know the breath. When in breath, may I be well. When out breath, may I be happy. And then things are okay. Breathing in, put. Breathing out, do. And you might find the mind's very happy to be with the breath. But when we are struggling, when there is challenges, there's something we can do. We can offer friendliness. We can offer kindness. We can generate skillful karma. And we can wrestle a little bit. It's a noble struggle. I'll tell one other story, since you're many of you Tanajan nuns students, as am I, big group there at Wat Lapjan. I've told the story before. It's a good one, so I'll tell it again. Back in, it was a long time ago. So it's my second Pansa, 26 years. In those days, the monastery only had about 20 monks. And that large area in front of the kitchen, between the hall where people are sitting now and in front of the kitchen, we used to have to sweep it every day. We just have to sweep around the Sala Bodhinyana and then down the road and then in front of the Dana Hall. And it was frustrating to me because the way the monks swept the leaves is that we swept them until there were none left at all. And I just used to find this frustrating because I wanted to go, but I'd been meditating before the bell to do my chore came, and I wanted to stop so I could go back and meditate again. I was very diligent, meditating a lot. But the way the monks swept the leaves as a group in those days, we would all start together at the Sala Bodhinyana, and then we'd come down and we'd sweep. And these days it's broken up. It's not like it used to be. Different groups do different areas. But in those days, one core group would do the whole area themselves, as well as mopping the sala and things. And so the way we swept the leaves would be that there'd be none left at all. And then the smallest little gentle breeze would come, of course, and then leaves would fall on the car park. And it's just kind of like, why? What, if we made it our objective to sweep most of the leaves, but not all of them, you could do it in half the time. But when you swept every single leaf, it just took so much longer. But that's the way we did it. And I remember being very frustrated. So I was like kind of stabbing away at these leaves with my self-righteousness. This is the wrong way to do it. There's a better way to do it. Why do you have to do it like this? I want to go and meditate. And what I noticed was the mind state disappeared by itself. That there was a spacious, bright, lovely, peaceful mind state. And my face smiled involuntarily. And I'm like, that's strange. Never experienced that before. And I noticed that the side of my peripheral vision, Lompur Anan, who in those days was about 45, Lompur Anan kind of walked past, bink, 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 quite sprightly, energetic, not yet middle-aged monk. And I'm like, now that's interesting. So I went to ask Thanachan the next day. I said, Thanachan, yesterday I was sweeping leaves and I was a bit grumpy, and all of a sudden my mind felt very bright and peaceful and I was happy and there was no suffering. I said, did you do something to help me? And he actually showed me, he did some body language for me to see. He raised his fist and he raised his hand and he did this. He said, yes, I knocked your negative mind state out of your mind with my metta because I wanted you to see that it's possible not to be miserable while sweeping leaves. And then I said, would you mind doing that every day? He said, no, I'm not doing that every day. You have to learn how to do it for yourself. But in those days, because maybe there was 15, 20 monks, hardly any lay people, most weekdays there was no kitchen making any meals. We ate the alms food, the greasy curries, cold greasy curries from plastic bags. And those were the days. And then people would come on the weekends, Saturday and Sunday, but on an ordinary weekday, there was very few guests. So Thanachan probably had a bit more time and a bit more energy for giving individual teachings to some of his disciples. So I remember that to this day, and he made an interesting point, isn't it? It's like, if there's metta in the mind and the body sweeping leaves, it doesn't have to be upset. I believe Lompur Cha did something similar with Ajahn Sumedho. Ajahn Sumedho was upset about something and looked back at Wat Po Phong, and Ajahn Cha came up to Ajahn Sumedho and says, Sumedho, you see that log down there in the forest? Is it heavy? Ajahn Sumedho looked at it and says, yeah, that looks like a heavy log. But Ajahn Cha says, but only if you pick it up, right? And then walked away. So it's like, yeah, the log is heavy if you try to pick it up. If you leave it where it is, it's not heavy. So Lompur Sumedho, Ajahn Chah gave Ajahn Sumedho a teaching about letting things go or not picking them up. And this is what our teachers can do for us. They can mirror for us in these important moments an attitude shift or a capacity, the potential of the mind that can be inspiring. Yeah. And then there's other benefits, because metta produces such powerful merit. It's said that metta, those who cultivate metta, the devas will protect them as well, and that poisons won't harm them. So very valuable, and one dies unconfused, one doesn't have bad dreams, all of that good stuff. So just check the time, how long have I been talking? 35 minutes, okay. Yeah, so there was one occasion in my life where that seems to have been the case, where I think devas were helping. I don't know, so it's kind of famous for giving a story about a Gribrajan using psychic powers and devas, so I better add one deva story before I finish, because I have to keep my reputation. So I was in Ladakh, actually, long time ago. Gosh, when was it? After my 12th Pansa, 16 years ago. The lay friend that I was with, we were at a Himalayan lake at 5,000 meters elevation, and we both really wanted to go there. And there was a chanting ceremony, an Amitabha ceremony going on, long life blessings, and there was going to be an archery show. And the car had been hired for a certain number of days. The yurt, the tent had been rented, and food had been bought, all these things. And I just had this feeling like I wanted to leave. I just felt the way it manifested was a irritation in the heart, like something's not okay. I just want to go. Something's not okay. Almost like having a, you know, those hairy worms that if they touch your skin, they cause itch. It's very unpleasant. It was almost like having a hairy worm in the heart. It's like just this discomfort, ill at ease, agitation that wouldn't go away. I'm like, how am I going to say this to the lay steward that spent all this money to get me here in this exotic situation so that we can meditate next to the turquoise-colored Himalayan's lake under the sapphire sky, boundless, beautiful emptiness? But I eventually said something because the feeling was so unpleasant and so persistent. So I said to him, Francois, his name is Francois, I just have a really strong feeling like I want to leave, and I don't know why. It's nothing external that I can see. And he says, you know what? I have that same feeling. I'm glad you said something. So the next day we left after the meal, and we were supposed to stay another 3 days, but we left after the meal. It turned out that it had rained the night before, and neither of us had thought anything about it because we come from a tropical country where it rains all the time. But apparently in Ladakh, it's a snow place where it snows, very high elevation, and rain is extremely rare. And what you get is snow melt, slow snow melt. But it rained heavily that night. We didn't know that that meant anything. But anyway, we drove out of that place, Lake Somariri, it was called, and we drove towards a town that we'd stayed on the night on the way coming in. And it turned out that a huge mudslide blocked the road out about 1 hour after we left. And then when we were going back to the lay, we noticed these big rocks on the road that had rolled down the hill, these huge mountains, big boulders on the roads, and we're having to dodge them. So we suddenly understood that a heavy rainfall in Ladakh is a very serious thing. And because there's no tree cover, extremely high, steep mountains and no tree cover. So if it rains a lot, big boulders roll down the hill. And you notice them in the valley. I hadn't really noticed them before. But on the way out, we noticed these huge, big boulders in the valley that had rolled down the mountainside. So we had to stop at one point, and people were pulling off. We actually helped to pull a big rock out of the road so we could pass. And then that night when we were back in Leh, 200 people died in a mudslide. It had just came down the mountain and took a village and in their sleep. And all of the bridges got washed away as well. So if we had stayed that one extra day, the road would have been impassable. The bridges would have been washed away. We would have had to be walking over Himalayan mountains without the right gear, trying to find another road out, which there might not have been. So it's just very interesting. And I would deduce from that occasion that some devas, you know, if we had more subtle faculties and if we were more refined, better in our cultivation, maybe the deva would have appeared in meditation and said, I think you should go. But because we were a bit more coarse than someone like Tanajan, what the deva probably could do was just make us feel a sense of disease to the point that we wanted to go. So we both left. And there were a group of Australians traveling with a friend of mine that were there treating nomads' eyes with doctors and things. And they got stuck there, and they actually had to climb over the mountains trying to find a road out for days. Very unpleasant. So I do believe this. I do believe that those who cultivate metta, those who are virtuous, those who wish well to beings, aim to help beings, don't harm beings, then the good will take care of them. So I have some experience in my own life of that that I thought I would share. I hope that something I said was helpful, and I do wish you every success in your mental cultivation. May you have many peaceful mind states, deep insights, and progress towards liberation swiftly.